Tonight, the particular topic we're talking about, I think is kind of interesting. Pastor Brown had mentioned this a little bit in some of his presentation, but it's a thing that is commonly used to try to defend the idea of evolution, and it's referring to vestigial organs, which basically means organs that we have as humans that we don't need, supposedly. That's the idea behind that, and that's supposed to somehow prove the idea of evolution. This particular study was again taken from the Answers in Genesis series by Ken Ham in the third book, actually, only it was actually penned by a man by the name of David Menton, and I have taken the material out of his particular chapter. Follow along with me. The vestigial organs have long been one of the classic arguments used as evidence for evolution. And I might also comment there's a lot of words in this material that I probably will mispronounce, or words that I don't use in my normal vocabulary, so I will stumble through them. The evolutionists say that living organisms, including man, contain organs that were once functional in our evolutionary past, but are now useless or have reduced function. Vestigial organs are considered by some evolutionists to be evidence against creation because they reason a perfect creator would not have made useless organs. The word vestige is derived from the word vestigium, which literally means footprint. The Merriam-Webster dictionary defines a biological vestige as a bodily part or organ that is small and degenerate or imperfectly developed in comparison to one more fully developed in an earlier stage of the individual, in a past generation, or in closely related forms. The first point here, Darwin on rudimentary organs. Charles Darwin was perhaps the first to claim vestigial organs as evidence for, vestigial organs as evidence for evolution. In his book, Origins of the Species, chapter 13, he speculates that these rudimentary organs once served a function necessary for survival, but over time that function became either diminished or non-existent. In his book, The Descent of Man, he claims about a dozen of man's anatomical features to be useless, including the muscles of the ear, wisdom teeth, the appendix, the coccyx, which is the tailbone, body hair, and semilunar folds in the corner of the eye. To Darwin, this was strong evidence that man had evolved from primitive ancestors, again indicating that we have these things that really are not needed because at one time in eons back they were very necessary but no longer are, which proves evolution. That's his thinking. The second point, the test of vestigial organs grows. In 1893, the German anatomist Robert Wittersheim expanded Darwin's list of useless organs to 86. Listed among Wittersheim's vestigial organs were such organs as the parathyroid, the pineal and pituitary glands, as well as thymus, tonsils, adenoids, appendix, third molars, and valves and veins. All of these organs have been subsequently shown to have useful functions, and indeed some have functions essential for life. Wittersheim's vestigial organs were presented as one of the so-called proofs of evolution in the famous Scopes monkey trial of 1925 that we talked about the other night. Horatio Hackett Newman, a zoologist from the University of Chicago, stated on the witness stand that there are, according to Robert Wittersheim, no more or no less than 180 vestigial structures in the human body, sufficient to make a man a veritable walking museum of antiquities. The third point, vestigial organs still used as evidence for evolution. For over 100 years, evolutionists have continued to use vestigial organs as evidence for evolution. In 1971, the Encyclopedia Britannica claimed there were more than 100 vestigial organs in man, and even as recently as 1981, some biology textbook authors were claiming as many as 100 vestigial organs in the human body. One of the most popular current biology textbooks declares that many species of animals have vestigial organs. Examples cited in humans include the appendix, the tailbone, and muscles that move in the ear. In addition to textbooks, countless popular science magazines, evolution blogs, and websites continue to promote vestigial organs as evidence of evolution. The Discovery Channel website says the human body has something akin to its own junk drawer, and that this junk drawer is full of vestigial organs or souvenirs of our evolutionary past. Number four, problems with the vestigial organs as evidence for evolution. Number one, why do useless organs persist? Darwin himself pointed out a flaw in the vestigial organs argument. In chapter 14 of Origin of Species, he said, it is scarcely possible that disuse can go on producing any further effect after the organ has once been rendered functionless. Some additional explanation is here requisite, which I cannot give. Why indeed would useless organs continue to exist for millions of years after they cease to have any selective advantage? And that is obviously a very logical point, that if they have become useless over thousands and thousands of years, then why somehow didn't they just disappear out of the body? That's what should have happened if that was really true in the evolutionary thinking. Point B, the loss of useful organs does not explain their origin. A problem for using vestigial organs as evidence for amoeba to man evolution is that the chief burden of the macroevolutionary explanation is to account for the spontaneous organ of new functional organs, not the loss of functional organs. While evolution might require the loss of functional organs, it is the acquisition of fundamentally new organs that remains unexplained by random mutations and natural selection. In other words, the loss of vestigial organs is downward, the opposite of upward movement that would require evolution to function. And basically, evolution is based on that idea that things get better and better and better. So you shouldn't have something that you're losing. You ought to have something you're gaining. Point C, how can we be certain an organ is useless? Man may declare an organ useless simply because he does not know what its purpose may be. Over the years, nearly all organs once thought to be useless have been now found to be functional. When we have no evidence for the function of an organ, it is well to bear in mind the absence of evidence is really not evidence of absence. In other words, just because maybe we don't understand something doesn't mean that it doesn't have a function. We simply may not have learned the function. Point D, declaring useful organs to be useless can be dangerous. Once an organ is considered to be useless, it may be ignored by most scientists, or even worse, surgically removed by physicians as a useless evolutionary leftover. I don't have any idea now when it was, but I remember years back somebody that had abdominal surgery, and I remember the comment was made that while the doctor was doing it, he took out the appendix because it had no purpose. So that evidently was something that was commonly done. Maybe it's still commonly done, I don't know. The oft-repeated claim that the human appendix is useless is a case in point. The evolutionist Alfred Riemer, in his book, The Vertebrate Body, said of the human appendix, its major importance would appear to be financial support of the surgical profession. Pretty good observation. One can only wonder how many normal appendixes have been removed by surgeons since Darwin first claimed them to be useless. Even more frightening would be the surgical removal of a useless parathyroid or pituitary gland. Point E, the definition of vestigial organs has been changed because the list of functionless organs has grown smaller with the advancement of knowledge. The definition of vestigial organs has been modified to include those whose functions are claimed to have changed to serve different functions. But such a definition removes the burden of proof that the vestigial organs are a vestige of evolution. Thus, the evolutionist must concede that the human coccyx, the tailbone, does indeed serve an important function in anchoring the pelvic diaphragm, but still insist, without evidence, it was once used by our ancestors as a tail. And we'll be talking about that a little bit more later. Point F, circular reasoning. The biggest flaw in the vestigial organs as evidence for evolution is circular reasoning. Evolutionists first declare vestigial organs to be a result of evolution. Then they turn around and argue that their existence is evidence for evolution. Point five, there are other explanations for vestigial organs, vestiges of embryology. Evolutionists insist on explaining vestigial organs only in the term of evolution, but other explanations are more plausible and even probable. For example, the human body does have many organs and structures that are clearly vestiges of our embryological development. While it is easy to prove that an organ or structure is a vestige of embryology, there is no evidence to prove that an organ is a vestige of evolution. We're going to mention three examples. The ligamentum, aortarism. This is the ductus aorticus, an artery that shunted blood from the pulmonary trunk to the descending aorta, thus bypassing the lung during fetal development. After birth, obliterated remnants of this remain in the body. In certain cases of congenital heart defects, the ductus aorticus continues to function for some time after birth to keep the baby alive. If you were to examine a cadaver, you would be able to find what they're talking about. I have never seen it, not interested in seeing it really. But those parts remain there, but they were there simply for the purpose of development while the baby was in the womb. And once the baby is born, those no longer have a purpose, yet there's still some remains of them that stay in the body, though they do not function. Then the ligamentum teres hepatis. This is obliterated remnant of the umbilical vein that shunted much of the oxygenated blood away from the liver to the inferior vena cava during fetal development, or the median umbilical ligament. This is obliterated vestige of the allantois, a pouch extending off the embryonic cloaca. The allantois disappears very early in gestation after functioning as a scaffold to help construct the umbilical cord. This remnant is seen as a ligament extending from the bladder to the umbilicus, or the belly button. B, then, sexual dimorphism. In most primates, there are striking anatomical differences between males and females of the same species. The differences between the sexes are referred to as sexual dimorphism. The skulls of a male and a female gorilla, for example, might not be recognized as from the same species if one had never seen them in the flesh. The differences between the sexes are not as dramatic in the case of humans, though they are dimorphic. The bodies of human males and females differ mostly in the organs related to reproduction. Up until the end of the sixth week of embryological development, the reproductive organs of the males and females are indistinguishable. After this time, the genital organs of both sexes develop from the same common starting tissues under the control of sex chromosomes, XX in a female, XY in the males, and various hormones. As a result of their embryological development from the same primordia, each sex contains vestigial components of the other sex. Almost every organ of the female reproductive system can be found in a different vestigial form in the male reproductive system and vice versa. For example, in the male, the prostatic utricle and pouching of the prostatic urethra having no known function, and a remnant of the paramesonephric duct that develops into the uterus and oviducts of the female. Clearly, the vestigial organs of the reproduction are not a result of evolution, but rather embryological development, which again simply explains the fact that these things develop normally and they're not something that really came about because of evolution and don't prove evolution in any way. Simply a matter of being created by God to function that way. Then homology. Homology is an underlying similarity between different kinds of animals recognized by both evolutionists and creationists. Many vestigial organs are examples of homology, but not necessarily of evolution. All terrestrial vertebrates, for example, share a widespread similarity, homology, of body parts. Evolutionists insist that this similarity is the result of evolution from a common ancestor. Creationists, on the other hand, argue that this similarity reflects the theme of a common creator and the need to meet similar biological requirements. All vertebrates with true limbs, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals, have the same basic limb structure, at least during their embryological development. The standard vertebrate limb consists of an upper limb comprising one bone, a lower limb comprising two bones, and a hand or foot bearing five digits, fingers and toes. Thus, the limbs of all limbed vertebrates share fundamental similarities, with each being specialized to meet the needs of each species. Horses have five digits while developing as an embryo, but generally all but one, the third digit, is absorbed before birth. Vestiges of the second and third metacarpal and metatarsal bones are visible in the modern horse as in the splint bones. Some fossil horses, however, have three toes, but both three-toed and one-toed horses have been found together in the fossil records. In the National Geographic magazine, for example, there is a picture of the feet of both the three-toed horse and the one-toed horse, and were found at the same volcanic site in Nebraska. Human hair is an example of homologous structure declared to be vestigial by evolutionists. All mammals have hair. Hair may vary from the compacted hairs of a rhinoceros horn to the quills of a porcupine. Dr. Menton said, to declare the unique hairs of one mammal to be vestigial to those of another is biological nonsense. It should say two there instead of and. Point number seven, evaluating currently claimed vestigial organs. We're going to discuss five vestigial organs that are considered the most important ones. The first one, the most common, the appendix. Ever since Darwin became known, the appendix has been the prime example of the useless organ. Life science says of the appendix, it is a vestigial organ left behind from a plant-eating ancestor. In the middle of the 20th century, surgeons often removed the appendix electively during abdominal surgery, assuming it had no function. Most evolutionists believe the appendix is a vestige of the ileum, an expanded area at the beginning of the large intestines, left over from our plant-eating ancestors. However, since humans have a well-developed ileum as well as appendix, the appendix can hardly be considered a vestigial ileum. In this book, The Vertebrate Body, evolutionist Alfred Romer said that the appendix is frequently cited as a vestigial organ, supposedly proving something about evolution. This is not the case. The absence or presence of an appendix or a ileum reveal no evolutionary pattern whatever. An appendix is not found in any invertebrate, amphibian, reptile, or bird. Only a few diverse mammals have an appendix. The appendix is found, for example, in rabbits and some marsupials, such as the wombat, but is not found in dogs, cats, horses, or ruminants. Both of the Old World and New World monkeys lack an appendix, while anthropoid apes and men have an appendix. The appendix is complex, highly specialized organ with rich blood supply, not what one would expect from a vestigial organ. If it was a truly vestigial organ, it would somewhat dry up. It wouldn't be something that would have a huge blood supply. The appendix is part of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, addressed by Galt, has long been suspected of playing an immunological role much like that of the tonsils and adenoids, also once considered to be vestigial. Recent evidence suggests that the appendix is well suited to serve as a safe house for the commensal, the mutually beneficial bacteria in the large intestine. Specifically, the appendix is believed to provide support for beneficial bacterial growth by facilitating re-inoculation of the colon with essential bacteria in the event that the contents of the intestinal tract are purged following exposure to a pathogen, which basically is the scientific reason they understand now why we have an appendix. It does have a very important part. B, male breast tissue and nipples. Evolutionists believe the male breast or mammary glands is a vestigial organ. Vestigial mammal glands in males can only be understood in terms of embryology, not evolution. Mammary glands begin to develop in both males and females in the sixth week of gestation. At the time of birth, the rudimentary mammary glands of males and females are identical. In both male and female, mammary glands may be slightly enlarged at birth and secrete a fluid that is commonly known as witch's milk. This results from hormones that induce milk production in the mother being passed through the placenta to the fetal circulation. The male mammary gland is clearly rudimentary or vestigial structure, but even the mammary gland of the non-lactating female might be considered vestigial. Female mammary glands are never fully developed and functional except during the times of breastfeeding the young. Should the evolutionists then consider non-lactating female mammary glands to also be vestiges of evolution? It simply comes down to the fact that our human bodies were designed by a creator and they function according to the duty of his design. It has nothing to do with anything evolutionary. The wisdom teeth, you've all heard about that. Years ago, I went into the Marquette Dental School to get my dental work caught up, and the first thing they said, "You don't need those wisdom teeth, we'll yank them out," and they did. Darwin was the first to popularize the idea that wisdom teeth are vestigial leftovers from our ape-like ancestors. Wisdom teeth, properly known as third molars, generally appear between the ages of 15 and 27 in both the upper and lower jaws of man. Many evolutionists consider them to be vestigial because, unlike apes, third molars often fail to develop properly in a man due to lack of space in the jaw. They argue that apes with their sloping face have longer jaws than man, and that when the ape-like creatures evolved into humans with a vertical face and shorter jaws, there was no longer room for third molars. Third molars are hardly useless vestiges. When there is an adequate room for the development, they are fully functional molars and are used in chewing much as the first and second molars. Thinking them to be vestigial, many dentists in the past routinely removed third molars whether or not they were causing problems. It has been estimated in America that only 20% of all the young people with otherwise healthy teeth develop impacted third molars that require medical attention, while in the past, nearly 9 out of 10 American teenagers with dental insurance had their molars extracted. Could money have something to do with it? Point D, the tailbone. I'm not sure I was pronouncing that word right before, but it's caxis is the way it's supposed to be pronounced. The so-called tailbone is perhaps the most commonly touted example of a useless evolutionary vestige. According to evolutionary dogma, the tailbone, properly called the caxis, because of its similarity to the shape of a cuckoo's beak, is a vestigial tail left over from our tailed monkey-like ancestors. Though the medical field is taken by this, they have refrained from surgically removing the normal caxis. The human caxis is a group of 4 or 5 small vertebrae fused in one bone at the lower end of our vertebral column. The caxis is commonly called the tailbone because of its superficial similarity to a tail. The caxis does not occupy the same relative position at the end of our vertebral column as does the tail in tailed primates, but then where else would it be? The vertebral column is a linear row of bones that support the head at one end and at the other end somewhere. Wherever it ends, evolutionists will be sure to call it a vestigial tail. Many modern biology textbooks give the erroneous impression that the human caxis has no real function other than to remind us of our evolutionary ancestry. However, the caxis has some very important functions. 6 muscles converge from the ring-like bones of the pelvic brim, anchor on the coccyx, forming a bowl-shaped muscular floor of the pelvis called the pelvic diaphragm. The incurved coccyx with its attached pelvic diaphragm supports the organs in our abdominal and pelvic cavities such as the urinary bladder, the uretus, the prostate, the rectum, and the anus. Without this critical muscular support, these organs would be easily herniated. Urethra, the vagina, and the anal canal pass through the muscular pelvic diaphragm, and thus the diaphragm serves as a sphincter for their structures, which actually is very important description of why we have the tailbone. The next one has to do with hair, the erector, and I'm not sure how you pronounce it, pili and body hair. Evolutionists have long insisted that human body hair and the small muscles, the erector pili, attached to these hairs are useless vestiges from our hairy ancestors. But human hair is as fully functional as that of any other mammal. The body of man, like most mammals, is covered with hair except for palms and soles. But man, unlike other mammals, has mostly tiny colorless hairs called vellus hairs covering the seemingly unhaired parts of his body. This gives humans the appearance of being hairless, with exception of such areas as the scalp, the axilla, the chest, and the genital organs. If we could count the tiny vellus hairs, humans have about as many hairs per square inch on their nose and forehead as they do on the top of their head. Hair density per square inch is approximately the same on the human body as it is in most primates. Hair grows from tube-like structures in the skin called hair follicles. Most hair follicles are capable of making more than one type of hair, depending in part on age, location, and hormonal stimulation. The first hairs to grow from the follicles of the developing baby are long, silky hairs called Langau hairs. These hairs, which cover most of the body, are usually shed before birth and are replaced with tiny vellus hairs. Thus, the newborn baby may appear to be mostly hairless, but in fact, is covered with vellus hair. The long pigmented hairs on the scalp and elsewhere on our body are called terminal hairs. Terminal hairs grow from the follicles that once produced lanugo and vellus hairs, and with age may be replaced once again with vellus hairs. For example, after a boy reaches sexual maturity, he may begin to lose terminal scalp hairs, which are replaced with vellus hairs, giving the appearance of baldness. Conversely, some vellus hairs in the face may be replaced with terminal hairs, producing a beard. Evolutionists argue that human body hairs are vestigial, useless, because there are so few long terminal hairs compared to tiny vellus hairs. Hair serves as a thermal insulation in most mammals, which is important because most animals are incapable of regulating their body temperature by sweating. Man, on the other hand, is a profuse sweater and can maintain body temperature over a much wider range of ambient temperatures from nearly all other mammals. Long body hair of the type seen on most animals would interfere with the evaporative water loss necessary for human thermoregulation by sweating. In most mammals, hair serves as an important barrier to ultraviolet radiation from the sun. While human scalp hair serves a similar function on the typical exposed top of our head, our primary defense against ultraviolet radiation damage is tanning and wearing clothes. An important function of hair is its sensory function. All hair follicles, regardless of size, are supplied with sensory nerves so that they can be considered to be mechanoreceptors. Our hairs are like leaves that, when moved by the physical stimulus, including air, send sensory signals to our brain. This is true of the tiny vellus hairs and the long terminal hairs. The sensory function of their hair can hardly be considered vestigial. Another important function of the hair follicles is the restoring of the epidermal skin surface following cuts and deep abrasions. Human hair follicles, regardless of size, serve as an important source of epidermal cells for recovering the skin's surface, whatever that word is. when broad areas of the epidermis are lost. If it were not for man's abundant hair follicles and sweat ducts, even routine skin abrasions might require a skin transplant. All hairs are associated with muscles and must have a muscle called the erector pilea, which serve to move the hair from its normal inclined position to a more erect position. In the case of the vellus hairs of man, this produces what is commonly called goosebumps. This muscle is in a position to help squeeze oil from the sebaceous gland, which are also attached to the hair follicles. Erector pilea muscles are supplied with the nerves of sympathetic nervous system, which is often associated with our response to flight and fright stimuli. Thus, when we are frightened, we may get goosebumps. We also may get goosebumps when we are chilled. Contraction of the erector pilea muscle produces heat, and if the response is inadequate to warm the body, shivering may follow, which involves repeated contractions of the large body muscles, which is rather interesting when you realize that that actually protects us from the cold, those hairs that are there. And then number 8 is the argument for vestigial organs, vestigial. Advancement in biology science today has raised serious doubts about vestigial organs as evidence of evolution. Even some evolutionists are now urging that vestigial organs be downplayed or even abandoned as evidence for evolution. An evolutionist, S.R. Setting, said, "Since it is not possible to unambiguously identify useless structures, and since the structure of the argument used is not scientifically valid, I conclude that a vestigial organ provides no special evidence for the theory of evolution. But like the long discredited recapitulation myth that embryo has passed through stages of their evolutionary history, vestigial organs continue to be used as evidence of evolution." And they really have nothing to do with evolution. They were simply designed by God, and we just haven't necessarily always figured out why they're there. Pastor Brown.